theme song, folks. FM. Yeah, there we go. The theme song you all know and love. For the next 2 hours, you can hang with us here on 96.3 FM. Call in number 427-3772 for bathroom spears, broadside, civil rights for the poor. The sleeping van struggle heightens as the city council sells out the homeless. We're going to have, lots of stuff. We have a report from San Francisco on the vicious jailing of three comedic theatrical activists who put a pie in the face of Mayor Willie Brown and now are serving 6 months in jail for this simple act of comedy. We're going to be talking with hopefully some folks calling in, and more on this as I get my papers straightened out. All kinds of news stories coming in. I just heard from my producer, Becky Johnson, that there's a story breaking in Richmond about the mayor of Richmond being concerned about a building being donated to the homeless, but I'll have to wait to get that story when we get more details. Before we go anywhere, and I guess we're going to really pick up from what happened at the city council on Tuesday night, which had really a marathon session, great sound and fury signifying very little. 7 hours, let's see, from 7:30 in the, actually even from 7 o'clock to all the way to about 2:30, the latest council session I've ever heard of, and I didn't get to bed till 4 o'clock on Wednesday morning, discussing a bunch of very, very small changes in the camping ordinance, even though people have been pressing for some fundamental, simple, limited, but effective changes that make it legal for homeless people to sleep and cover up with blankets somewhere in the city, and then one would hope soon that there would be at least low-income campgrounds where the 500 to 1,500 homeless people that are not sheltered in Santa Cruz have to sleep out every night can go without Michael Ratkin smearing them all over the media, all over the city council, and all over the world as people that have to sleep outside, because otherwise there'll be hundreds of thousands, this is a quote, hundreds of thousands more coming to town. When we have such ignorance or outright, I don't want to say stupidity, because Mike Ratkin is not stupid. This councilman has been on the winning team for 20 years in the sense that he's come up victorious at election time. He maintains a slick rep up on campus as a liberal, while in fact on the homeless issue he has been anything but. I mean, it was a very interesting debate in any case, for many reasons, on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning. But as I said, very little came out of it. And we're going to run through the changes. I'm going to kind of go through them by memory while I wait for a copy of them to make its way to the studio. But fundamentally, there was a change in the law that allows people to sleep without bedding. So if you want to freeze your ass off at night, it will not be illegal to sleep without bedding. Although, the more I look at this section, the more I wonder if the police can find some way around it. It obviously is kind of bizarre, the idea that, what, do you want homeless people to freeze to death? Is that part of the plan? Or to get completely soaked and drive them out of town? Maybe that's part of the brainstorm that they have in mind. That was one change that was made. They made no change in the hours, though there was some talk about changing the current hours of illegality from 11 to 8:30 in the morning to from 2 to 6 in the morning, but that change didn't happen. There was a reduction in the fines. So that instead of it being $162 per sleeping citation or covering up with blankets citation under 6.36, it will now be a $54 citation. And it was also, I guess, there was a change to the effect that any person who violates that section may, in lieu of a fine, be required to do no more than 8 hours of community service, as distinguished from the 30 or 40 hours that referee meat grinder Mulligan of the county basement, I think he belongs in the basement, or belongs below the basement, regularly turns out. So there's no, of course, the relevant fact is that there is a fine for sleeping, that there is a penalty for doing what everybody has to do at night. And the implications of this, at which we've talked about at great length, are many. They mean that people cannot safely sleep in areas patrolled by the police because they have to worry about being cited or arrested by the police. It means that women have to fear rape because they have to move to unsafe areas or risk tickets. It means once you've gotten a ticket for this or some other minor infraction and you can't pay it, a warrant is out for your arrest, so you don't, as a second reason for you to avoid the police and avoid safer, well-lit, better patrolled areas because you're afraid that the warrant will be out. And this, of course, is the reason that even if the fine is a smaller one, $54 instead of $162, the fact that there is a warrant out for you will mean that you have to face jail in any case, the same disruption, the same stigmatization, the same danger, I have to say danger, that you face going into jail. We have an incoming call, and caller, hang with us for a moment. There was also a slight reduction so that sleeping in blankets are now infractions rather than misdemeanors. But this is not particularly relevant because an infraction, they never charge these crimes as misdemeanors unless they're dealing with protesters, and then they always drop the misdemeanor charge before it reaches the courts. Because if you charge someone with a misdemeanor, you are obliged to give them a jury trial and a public defender. And that certainly puts a crimp in the in their system. If they, are they going to find 12 people who will send someone to jail for up to 6 months for sleeping? I suppose it's theoretically possible. In fact, maybe it's more probable than I like to admit. I, after all, was convicted of serving people free food in 1994 by a jury who heard the facts. And while they were very sympathetic to me, they kind of followed the court order that forbade Food Not Bombs from serving food in San Francisco lockstep, even though there was nothing wrong with the food we were serving. It was a political maneuver to get homeless people out of public places. But the jurors are often intimidated by judges, by this guy in the costume sitting on the high bench who tells them that if they don't behave, they'll be subject to penalties and so forth and so on, even if he isn't telling the truth. Even if jurors do have the ultimate right to say no to unjust laws, which they do. Jurors are the ultimate judge of both law and fact in our society, in our trials. And if the jury thinks the law is unconstitutional, they can find the defendant not guilty, and there isn't a damn thing the judge can do about it. And that is the truth for all of you listening. It's called jury nullification. Anyway, we're talking about the City Hall and what happened there in terms of the sleeping ban on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning, and what minor changes, which took hundreds and hundreds of hours of staff time and activist time and police time, so that this city council could posture that it was actually doing something. I mean, it's amazing the amount of energy they put into this whole situation. They also ruled that you couldn't have a camping misdemeanor unless, before, it would be if you got two tickets within 48 hours, then the second one could be charged as a misdemeanor. Now you have to get two tickets within 24 hours for that to be charged as a misdemeanor, and those cannot be sleeping or blanket tickets. Again, these are not final changes in the law. These are changes that will be debated when council returns in its second March session on March 24th, Tuesday evening. And then finally, there was a section about the National Guard Armory. Any citation issued for a violation of this chapter, meaning a camping ticket, shall be, or a sleeping ticket, or a blanket ticket, shall be dismissed by the city attorney in the interest of justice if at the time of the citation issuance, the winter shelter at the Santa Cruz National Guard Armory is filled to capacity, which sounds like a good idea. It certainly is good not to arrest people for sleeping when there's no shelter. What's not a good idea is that the fact that, one, this doesn't apply once the armory closes, and that's when most of the problems occur, because after March 15th, when the armory closes, there will be 500 to 1,500 homeless people out on the streets with less than 30 spaces for them to use as emergency shelter each night on the floors of the Interfaith Satellite Church program. So it's going to be completely irrelevant until November, when the armory reopens, if it reopens. Right now there is no specific plan for that to happen that I'm aware of. This was the last year of the armory, though the new governor may have something to say about that. And frequently the armory is this kind of this situation where many people don't go there because of all kinds of problems. There's health problems, everybody's together coughing and sneezing and wheezing in many cases. There's problems of the staff, where there's a kind of a rigid authoritarian structure. We've heard complaints about the people who are running it, Papa John and a woman named Suga, who tossed us out when we went up there to get complaints from people who wanted to give them to us about the beating of homeless people who tried to give them some soup. It was a couple weeks ago. We got a kind of a smile and a song from Homeless Services Center Director Karen Gillette, who oversees all this, but no real guarantee that we would. In fact, we were told we really couldn't come back because the people up there didn't want us. Not the case, as far as we know, based upon the people we were talking to, and also individuals who go into the armory don't have to meet a majority vote, usually. They just simply have to follow the rules, and we were following the rules, except for the one that we arrived late. Other than that, we were following the rules, and we were not, nor were we engaged in violating the sergeant's rules at the armory. It wasn't the sergeant who objected to us. It was the kind of the rigid staff reappointed by Karen Gillette, and hopefully these problems will be taken care of in the future, but it's a difficult thing for people. They can't go into the armory for some reasons. They may be couples. They may be interested in, they maybe have a late night job. Although I think that situation, there is one late night pickup, though I might point out there was no late night pickup for the sleeping ban debate, which happened, the most important debate, at least in terms of its potential impact on homeless people. Not that the city council did anything, but they had on the agenda things that could have been done. and that weren't done, like a real change in the sleeping ban. That actually was never put on the agenda per se, but it was always there as a possibility. And at one point, Councilmember Sugar made an amendment, and Councilmember Crone tried to make an amendment. There were two different amendments that would have decriminalized sleeping. Sugar's amendment said that if there was no shelter space available on a particular evening, or until there was shelter space and a shelter called in, there could be no tickets issued. This was the wording that we proposed. His amendment was somewhat slightly different. He said something to the effect of, if the winter armory shelter is full or closed, no tickets shall issue. And that was immediately jumped on by former mayor and bumbuster Mike Rotkin, who has made a career on this issue out of liberal-coded bigotry. But as I said, the final thing that was passed was the so-called National Guard armory exception. If the National Guard is filled to capacity, then the cops can come, wake you up, roust you, give you a ticket, force you to move down the road, take pictures of you, ID you, tell you to get out of town, because there is no legal place to sleep, and there still is no legal place to sleep under these ordinance changes. But the next morning, be happy, the city attorney can dismiss the tickets. So, that's the great series of reforms that Mayor Byers and her task force, as I call it, came up with. And it went on for 7.5, 8 hours. It was the longest such debate on the camping ban ordinance in history, I'm sure, in this community. And the problem was, it was not really around, mostly, not really around any substantive matters. And we're going to be talking more about this. We're going to be hearing some quotes from the debate. I hope you're going to be calling in if you were at this discussion and talking it over with us, or with me anyway. We're hoping to have in the studio later Becky Johnson, who wrote an article on the subject for the next March issue of Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper. But before we go any further, let's take a musical break. And remember, our phone lines are open, 427-3772. Yes, we do. Hey, we're talking to Dan Hopkins. A little problem with the phone there, listeners. Sorry about that. And Dan, you were at the city council meeting on Tuesday night. Are you calling about that, or you got something else in mind?
I was thinking more in terms of that, a little bit. I don't have too much to say tonight, just a little bit. I was mainly, the meeting. I think one of the things that I thought was really odd, was when a few people that opposed the sleeping ban and the blanket ban spoke of setting their alarm at 2 o'clock in the morning so that they could get up and go check and see if there was homeless people sleeping around.
Oh, this was one of the people who actually favored keeping the sleeping van?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was in favor of keeping the sleeping van, and there was actually more than one person that said this.
There was a small but kind of little embattled group from the downtown neighbors who have been adamantly fighting any changes at all in the camping ordinance, even though, ironically, the changes that a lot of us have been talking about, like a campground and sleeping in industrial zones, would actually take vehicles and sleepers away from the neighborhoods and make it probably less likely that they would be in the neighborhood, since there would be a legal place for people to sleep. And I remember what you were talking about, Dan. You said that this woman was saying that, well, if the hours
when it's illegal to sleep are only between 2 and 6, as what was proposed originally by the task force, then they'll have to get up at, you know, 2 in the morning to make a complaint about a sleeper. And in fact, we found, those of us who actually attended these stupid task force meetings that went on and on and on and talked about very little, was that police are happy to come out any time of the day or night and tell homeless people to move and say that there's a problem, and they do the same in the county as well, even though there's no law that makes it criminal for people to sleep at night except in very limited areas. So that she was mistaken. The police will come out at any time, and they will tell the homeless that they, the homeless man or woman that's there, that they're not wanted there. And I think that that's probably enough for almost any person to get a cop to come and tell you that. I don't think that you or other homeless people, and you're homeless at the moment, right?
Right.
Normally seek out confrontations with the police or want to get into long arguments with them.
Oh, right. And you know, it really gets me. I guess maybe some few homeless people may sleep in somebody's yard, but I don't know, for me, you know, that's the last thing I want to do is sleep in somebody's yard.
Well, the whole issue of the yard, Dan, is completely bogus, because as you and I both know, there are trespass laws that have nothing to do with the sleeping ban that are the appropriate recourse for somebody sleeping in your yard. I mean, it's any change in the sleeping ordinance. Indeed, if the entire camping ordinance were removed, there would still be trespass laws. It would make it a criminal misdemeanor, to be sleeping on someone's property, and when told to leave, if you refuse to leave, that's trespass, and you get to go to jail for that, and you face up to 6 months in jail. And I guess one of the things that people were saying was, oh, well, we want the police to do it. We want to be able to hide behind our shuttered houses so these evil, horrible, ugly, smelly, possibly dangerous kidnapper, child molester, homeless people don't, we don't have to associate with them, but the police can go out there and do it without us saying anything. And the police say, well, you're going to have to file a complaint. Well, I mean, I got news for you folks in the houses. You know, if you have a problem and you're unwilling to take it up directly with the person, then you do have to file a complaint and you do have to testify in court. And if you think that's such a big deal, imagine what's happening to the person who has no place to stay. Not that you should allow them to abuse your rights or abuse your property. You have a right to say, look, move along. I don't want you on my property. And that's going to be the case whether there's a sleeping ban or a camping ban or not. And it's going to take citizen participation regardless.
Right, that's right. And that's what I can understand. You know, I mean, heck, me as a homeless person, last thing I'd want to do is sleep in somebody's yard, you know? And like you said, they're just as bogus as they could be. And then I think the thing that really got me was when those two said they would have to set their alarm at 2 o'clock, you know? And it's like, why would they set their alarm? And it was totally bogus because, how would they know that any homeless person was there? In other words, it's not legal to sleep in anybody's yard anyway.
Exactly.
You know,
but it's interesting, Dan, because that kind of argument, I think, persuaded the mayor and the city council to delete the change in the hours. I thought the change in the hours was ridiculous for other reasons. I think the idea that you're doing homeless people a favor by changing the hours from 11 to 8:30 down to 2 to 6 as some sort of big favor is bullshit. I mean, that's nonsense. But I think it may be that Mayor Byers and Crone and Sugar and Fitzmaurice, who were the four people supporting this, I would presume, at least three of them were, changed it because they also heard from everybody who favored changes that this was completely ridiculous and they didn't make any difference. So why antagonize the neighborhoods if you're not going to get credit as the great wonderful liberals for, you know, decriminalizing slavery for a number of hours a day, that sort of thing?
It's terrible. Anyway, I'm still hoping. I guess I'm being a little optimistic, you know. I'm still hoping that something's going to be done, you know.
Well, have you found anything that you've liked in these legal changes? Have you read them over? Have you heard about them?
I didn't get to stay the whole meeting, so I don't even know what the...
As I was saying before, the main legal changes are, one, they lessen the fines. The fines are going to be a maximum of $54, which actually is a significant change in a way that most people aren't aware of. Most people are aware that this sleeping ban citation is $162, but they're not aware that it can go as high as $1,000, even for an infraction. Hence, Father Marini, who had a pavilion which he opened to homeless people back in the summer of 1996, was threatened with $1,000 fines by the city under infraction.
And I think that was per day.
Sorry?
Per day.
per day, exactly.
So
that fine would be gone, and I suppose, I mean, that might be a, I mean, some generous church could then say to the police, fuck you, we'll take the $54 a day fine, come in and fine us. Of course, that, I guess, would be $54 for every particular person. They were actually paying, this is what Catherine Byers pointed out, churches were paying for the tickets of people sleeping on their property, and so in 1995, the city council moved to make it legal for three homeless people to sleep on a piece of church property in a vehicle, only three vehicles total per church. What of course Catherine Byers did not say is that for almost every church in town, it is still illegal, including under the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, for anybody to be sleeping there at all, because churches are not domiciles, and under our crazy sleeping ban law, it affects not just public property, but private property. It's illegal to have somebody on your private property unless it's inside a house. And churches are not considered houses in the sense of being a place where people live, generally speaking.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, one thing that was not brought up is the entire Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program is itself illegal. And it's interesting that this wasn't brought up, because it shows that the whole thing is a political, has this clear political nature to it, that they don't want to antagonize, the city council doesn't want to antagonize the most reactionary sectors of the community, the police, the Sentinel, and the media, the businesses, the Chamber of Commerce, and some of the downtown, I don't think most neighbors, but some of the conservative downtown neighbors, like the downtown neighbors, like the Harvey West Association and so forth.
Right. It's so political, like you say, you know, it's just unreal, you know, and a lot of this is bigotry and classism and all kinds of stuff like that, you know, it's just like horrible.
Well, it's a form of stereotyping, and we're going to talk about hate crime later, because I believe one person said that he was concerned that some people would be afraid that their kids would have to go to school walking past homeless people sleeping in vans, and they might have to worry about their children being kidnapped. And he when I talked to him earlier today, he said he wasn't necessarily sure this was a legitimate fear, but that it was a fear people had that the city council had to deal with. And I'm all for people getting psychotherapy for their fears, but I think that the city council should be more concerned with the human rights of people being oppressed in our town than with the apprehensions of middle class folks at home who have nothing better to do than worry about people that they choose not to associate with and want to exclude entirely. I mean, I think that is not a legitimate function of the city council, except in the most cheap political sense, and that they have to, you know, eventually have to get reelected, so they got to worry about that at some level. But their job is to make sure people secure their rights, and particularly the council members we elected, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar.
Yeah, especially like the one comment that Jim Costner made when he was up there was that we're all created equal, you know, and that we're not supposed to designate some people unequal, you know. He said something to that effect, you know, and that really struck me, you know, that's exactly what's happening. That some people are just considered in another class and they're to be inferior, you know.
I mean, it's amazing to me. I was looking at the Cabrillo Voice today, and there was a big editorial on gay bashing. And, you know, people were talking about it and how really cruel and stupid it is the woman was beaten up because she was a lesbian. And, you know, it's a real hate crime is what it is. Nothing the woman did per se, just what she is in terms of her sexual orientation. Well, homeless people, as you know, are facing exactly the same kind of vicious prejudice in action, and at least 12 people that I have heard of, either first or second hand, have been kicked awake, their eyes blackened, some have stitches in their head, one man has a fractured, if not broken, ribs from what people calling themselves troll busters, people who call human beings, almost human people, trolls, as people who would live under a bridge. And this is considered, I suppose it's not considered acceptable in a certain sense, but I have not seen one story in the Chronicle about, or in the Sentinel or the Metro about this issue in Santa Cruz, even though the police and the Sentinel and the mayor's office know all about these violent assaults. And I think these violent assaults come from allowing this kind of hysteria, which the Mayor Byers' wild goose chase of pursuing the so-called examination of the camping ordinance without being specific and saying, no, it's not the camping ordinance, it's the sleeping ban, stupid. It's the sleeping sections of the camping ordinance and the right of homeless people to sleep that we need to address, and that we are going to say to you people in the neighborhoods, yeah, we're concerned about all your problems. Yeah, we're going to listen to you, but we were elected to make sure that all of our people get basic human rights. I never heard that from Crone. I never heard that from Sugar. I never heard that from Byers or Fitzmaurice in terms of any regular statement to people as to why this task force was in existence. No, I just heard, oh, well, we're going to listen to everybody in here. Everybody has to say about the camping ordinance. And then you got this mass hysteria from the neighborhood conservatives that, oh, they're just going to have us camping and putting up tents on our sidewalk and crapping in our yards.
No, that's just ridiculous.
And this is the responsibility of the city council. I mean, I don't like what the downtown neighbor people said, but I tell you, I understand their fear and their apprehension, because it almost seemed like Mayor Byers orchestrated this whole thing. She didn't want any real changes in this ordinance, so she called out the racist dogs by doing this kind of whole tactic of saying, I just want to examine the entire camping ordinance. Anyway, that's...
Something that I was thinking about today was, they claim that if they make any changes in that camping ban, or the sleeping ban, rather, or the blanket ban, that, all kinds of people from all over the United States will come to Santa Cruz, And it's really funny because, they try as hard as they can in this town to make sure that all the tourists come from all over the United States come here, and it's just like a parallel, I think you would call it, or something
right.
Like that, where... Well, we can bring all these people as long as they have money. But
right.
If they don't have money, we want them out of here, And
it's true, and that is really, I mean, one can understand that in some sense. But I'm going to move on, Dan, because
yeah,
I want to give a couple of other folks a chance to get in. Anything else you want to say?
Oh no, not at all. I just hope the listeners out there will support us and maybe call the city council. I don't know what their new number is.
By the way, Dan, there is a meeting of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and this is open to anyone listening who wants to be a part of our resistance to these bad laws. And we're going to try to, since the city council seems to be taking no action whatsoever to really change the sleeping core, the criminalization of poor people at night for the crime of sleeping or for covering up with blankets, we're going to begin monitoring the courts very closely and teaching people the use of a necessity defense. That's going to begin tomorrow at 10:30 at this meeting of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That's going to be happening at 706 Frederick Street. For anyone who's interested in coming, that's Frederick and Soquel. It's on the east side. You do have to make your way there, but if you get to the house, it's going to be at Becky's house. Come on up and join the meeting.
All right.
It's 10 o'clock or 10:30 tomorrow, Friday.
Uh-huh.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Okay, we'll see you. Bye.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Theodora from Yes On In.
Ah, yes. And, of course, is the measure that would stop doctors and state bureaucrats from putting strange medications in our drinking water.
Well, that's the gist of it. It would ban the use of our water system to deliver any product or substance whose purpose is to alter or affect our physical or mental functions.
Mm-hmm.
And it would also ban fluoridation,
mm-hmm.
which has actually been, what lit the fire under our tails, got us busy on this issue. The state in 1995, our wonderful state, mandated that all communities over 10,000 have to put this industrial waste product in their water and help with the disposal of, of our industrial waste, being that we're a chemically based society, so everybody has to swallow a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, even a little bit does great damage.
Well, I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, Theodora, since we don't have a dentist in the studio. What is all this, hysteria about fluoridation, I hear folks say? Actually, I don't hear folks say. I read certain dentists say in the paper. My dentist, in fact, says the same thing. It says fluoridation helps your teeth. And if you're a poor person, how are you going to get your teeth fluoride? You have to go get, you know, capsules and tablets. I mean, how, you know, you
well, first of all, for the poor children, the fluoride tablets are available through the county health and Medi-Cal, and they're not even that expensive. It's probably one of the cheaper medical services people can get.
How much are they?
I think somebody said it was around $18 a year to supply. And not to mention toothpaste, which are, you know, it's virtually almost impossible unless you go to a health food store and try really hard to get a fluoride-free toothpaste.
Now, would that be, would the dentists claim that a fluoridated toothpaste would have the same effect on teeth as fluoridated water?
Well, you know, the ideal thing about fluoride treatments and fluoride toothpaste is that they're topical. They go exactly where you want them to, which is on the teeth. When you swallow fluoridated water, you are flushing that fluoride through your whole system, which means all your bones, and actually it does go into the brain. It does go past the brain-blood barrier. Not the right word for it, but there's actually the most recent studies in 98 showed that at the level they want to fluoridate the water, which is one part per million, produces changes in the brain, damages brain tissue, very similar to Alzheimer's and dementia. It also causes kidney damage. So that's at the level they want to put
the name
in
of the study is?
Let's see. It was published in Brain Research. I don't have all my materials.
Well, let me ask you this.
It was published in the Journal of Brain Research, which is a peer-reviewed journal. And that's the other thing, is that a lot of, you know, the dentists tell you they've got studies, and they do. But their studies, by and large, have been published in the public health journals, which are not peer-reviewed, are not blinded studies, and they will publish anything if it serves the public health agenda, and fluoridation is part of the public health agenda.
Now, what is the public health agenda? What does that mean?
Well, the public health agenda is, right now, is that communities be fluoridated, that all children receive various vaccines, and the current one they're pushing is, I believe, the hepatitis B vaccine, pushing it on young children. Now, this is a disease that can only be transmitted, I believe, sexually and through the blood. Now, most of the young'uns, and we're talking junior high and below, are not sexually active, so why do they need this vaccine? And my understanding, too, is this vaccine is not one that lasts you your whole lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was one they'd have to repeat, you know, I don't know what
right, but getting
frequency.
Back to,
but
getting back
again,
to fluoride.
Again, these are agendas that they have that are very invasive in terms of, you know, for many people in Santa Cruz.
By the way, you're talking about the federal health department, the state
public health? Health department, yeah, the federal public health department.
And what kind of input does the citizenry have to this department, and who controls that agenda?
Well, that I can't tell you. I mean, I'm not operating at those levels, but it's very hard. You know, it's very hard to have an impact at those levels because it is, you know, the collusion between corporations and government agendas, and you know, it's pretty complete at this point. So it's, you know, the short, that's why we're doing an initiative, because it's only the vote of the people that really can get us off the fast track for, you know, what the public health agenda is.
Well, currently we have, I guess, the folks who are working for Yes on N, which is the anti don't put, you know, medical num-nums in our water,
right.
Please.
Yes on, what we're saying is yes on no fluoride.
Yes on no fluoride. You folks were able to successfully, during the last city council, which many of us regarded as a sort of a nasty conservative council trying to develop to death the beach flats and sell out homeless people down the road. Unfortunately, the current council doesn't seem too much better in this second regard, but you were able to get them to pass 6-1, Cynthia Matthews dissenting, I guess, a proposal that there be no fluoridation of the water without a vote of the people?
Right, right.
And so there's some who claim, for example, the Metro Santa Cruz, which seems to be taking a pro-fluoridation position, wouldn't you say?
I didn't read the article, so I can't say.
Ah, yes. It's an interesting article by, I guess, John Ewell. And he talks a lot about how there's a statewide organization which is trying to use Santa Cruz as a test case to fight fluoridation at the state level. Not that this is necessarily a bad idea, but what's your sense of this? Is this an accurate allegation?
Well, I think, you know, I didn't work directly on writing the language of the ordinance, but I have worked closely with Jeff and the other folks in the organization. And, you know, the other side is trying to paint that, you know, Jeff is an outside agitator or somebody coming. He's not. He's an expert. That's all. We've called on the expert that we know, this organization, Citizens for Safe Drinking Water, that were involved in the statewide initiative effort in 97 to pass an initiative statewide that would ban fluoridation. And, you know, they've been working at this for, I think he's only been working at it for 2 or 3 years, but, you know, very much has collected a lot of the information. And he's a resource. He's not, we're the ones doing the work. We're the ones putting our lives on hold while we do this last year, while we've gathered the signatures and now are doing the campaign. It's very grassroots. And, you know, deceptive, the tactic they're taking, because they don't want to deal with the information directly. They'd rather play personal politics, because it's a lot easier to cast innuendo than cite what your studies are. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, when we get into debates with these people, they don't know what, you know, they can't cite anything.
Well, talking about debates, Theodore, and we're talking to Theodore Carey of the Yes on N committee, is that accurate?
Well, it's Santa Cruz Citizens for Safe Drinking Water, Yes on N.
And how can people get in touch with you for more information?
475-8914.
475-8914.
But speaking of information, the issue is out there. If you pick up virtually any of the local weeklies, you will see some kind of article. The Connection, the current Connection magazine, has several wonderful articles, and with their citations on the studies of what this issue is about. Good Times has a so-so article, but I've got a letter to the editor in there that's very explanatory.
I like that letter, yeah.
Dish Wrap has a good article. I understand City on the Hill has something. I'm sure the Epicenter and Comic News has something about it. And you mentioned the Metro article.
When you finish with this issue, Theodora, I want you to take over the sleeping ban.
Give me time to rest, but I haven't been able to be working, so I might very well be homeless by the time this issue's over.
I hope not. But then I'm sure that Mike Rotkin will tell you that it's all for the best.
Well, you know, you were on the right track when you were trying to get the initiative done, and I'm sorry I wasn't more helpful on that, and I'm sorry more people in this community weren't more helpful, because that's where we really make the changes.
And, of course, for those who aren't aware of it, the Sleeping Ban Repeal Initiative was an initiative which we got 3,000 signatures from registered city voters last year,
mm-hmm.
which actually set up safe zones in the sense that it's
very intelligent initiative, and that would have forced the community to have a dialogue on the issue, and that's, you know, and because we've got this initiative, we're definitely getting more and more people talking about it. And ultimately, this is an educational campaign, because everybody who's learned about fluoridation is somebody who's not going to quietly swallow this poison. People who are in the know now are, you know, if we lose this initiative, because of the city ordinance, there still will be some kind of election before they fluoridate us to choose whether we want to be fluoridated or not.
But you're trying to entrench the
issue. But what we're trying to do with Yes on N is to enact a prohibition, not just vote on whether we want fluoride or don't want fluoride, because an election like that is only as good as it is in the moment. They can come back in a year and say, well, maybe you want it now, so let's vote again.
Mm-hmm.
And they can keep coming back and keep coming back. Well, maybe you want it now. And, you know, that's very hard on activists to have to, gear up every year to fight
right.
the power. But when we have a prohibition in place that's been placed there by the people, it cannot be overturned.
What's coming
up? It can only be overturned by the people.
Theodore, what's coming up in terms of meetings or public forums that people should know about?
Okay, we have a parent and community forum It's not, I don't say we, we're going to be at one. It's being organized by a group called Coalition of Concerned Parents and Educators, folks that, you know, that are confused about the issue and want to get both sides together to talk about it. So we will be there with our information, and so will they, and that's this Saturday from 1 to 3, and that's going to be at the Bayview Multipurpose Room, and Bayview's the elementary school at the corner of Bay and Mission Streets.
So it's Bay and Mission, 1 o'clock on Saturday.
1 o'clock, and Joe Grossman from Community TV, Voices from the Village, will be the moderator, and he's a wonderful moderator, very fair and neutral.
Let me interrupt briefly to say that, indeed, Voices from the Village, under another moderator, is happening tonight at 7:30, and that's going to be the sleeping band debate.
Oh, okay.
For anybody who wants, that's a call-in number is 425-4920 if you can catch channel 71 on at 7:30, from 7:30 to 8:30 tonight. The sleeping band debate, 425-4920. But let's get back to your number.
It's 7:30 to 8:30?
It is.
Because right before that, on at 7 o'clock on Thursday, is a club cruise. And I believe Becky did this. It's pre-recorded. But it's a couple of the Yes on End folks and whatever else she's
got. That's channel 71. So it's the same channel. So I guess you can start at 7 and
keep going.
And start with your teeth and end up with your pillow, you know.
Yeah, it's all connected. It really is. It's disregard for human rights. And that's really what it comes down to.
One would think that people should have the right to say no to something in their drinking water, particularly if there's an alternate way of getting the same kind of service to people who need it.
And people should have the right to say who sleeps in their driveway, who sleeps in their backyard. Churches should have the right to open their doors to whoever they choose to. These are fascist laws, and the F word is definitely a heavy duty word.
Now, you don't want to offend the mayor by using that word now.
Well, we should probably tie it up because I'm off to somewhere else to keep getting the word out.
Well, one more time, we're talking to Theodora Curie of the Yes on N committee, Santa Cruzans for Safe Drinking Water.
Mm-hmm.
And give us your number again, Theodore.
475-8914.
And of course,
I just want to do a pitch. Anybody out there who's a registered Santa Cruz City voter, don't sit this one out. This is. Don't think because you buy bottled water you're safe. You bathe in the water and you absorb it through your skin. You water your vegetables, your gardens with it. The vegetables will draw up the fluoride and have a higher fluoride content. What 99% of the water that comes through our tap winds up in the environment, whether that's the aquifers or the rivers or the backyards or Monterey Bay Sanctuary. There's no getting away from this one. It's just imperative that people show up and vote and say yes on in and tell these well-meaning but very ignorant people doing the bidding of the industrial toxic waste people that they don't get their way in Santa Cruz.
Just say no.
This is actually real interesting. Let me mention this to your listeners. The woman who brought this issue forward in the state legislature and sponsored it and ushered it through all the committees and got people lined up to vote for this mandate is a woman named Jackie Spear. And she happens to be in town tonight over at the SEIU Union Hall on Mission Street, I believe, in Locust. Mm-hmm. And she'll be speaking at 7:30. But the point I want to make is this woman, her claim to fame was that she went down with Leo Ryan in the mid-80s down to Jonestown.
Mid-70s.
Pardon?
Mid-70s.
Was that the 70s?
1978.
Late 70s. She went down to Jonestown with Leo Ryan. She was his aide. And they were going down to investigate what was going on there. And that of course, precipitated the whole shootings at the airport and then the poisonings at Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wounded. Leo Ryan was killed and she was wounded. And she rose to power because she was his aide and, you know, she became the one heiress apparent that took over his job and was elected. And just the irony that this is why this woman has any, credibility or fame at all was because she was shot at Jonestown. And the irony of this woman coming back to California And it seems like the only thing she learned in Jonestown was how to make poisonous Kool-Aid. And that's, you know...
Give us your number again, Theodore, if people want to call in.
475-8914.
And again, we're coming up in 10 minutes. You can see a show on Club Cruise, Channel 71.
Great.
To check out this in a more, well, more extended fashion that we can cover here on Free Radio.
Right.
Hey, thank you
well,
very
thank
much, Theodore.
Thank you too, Robert. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, and keep calling in.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Carol Denny from her album Failure to Disperse, This Town Gets Ready for Christmas. You've heard that before and you'll hear it again on the show. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert, and this is the Thursday edition, the February 25th edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. We're covering a number of topics, including the upcoming Measure N. You've just heard Theodora Carey talking about that. But most important, we're focusing on the sleeping ban debate, which is kind of reached a brief culmination there last Tuesday. And we have, when the City Council did its 7-8 hour marathon talk, Becky Johnson is in the studio. Hi, Becky. And we have an errant mic here. I'm going to have a little problem with it. I'm sorry if we blast out your radio. So Becky, you were not only at the city council debate, but you were also you spent the morning writing a story for Street Spirit on the issue.
Yeah, that's right. I wrote an article that was sort of my take on what the council did and didn't do at that city council meeting on Tuesday the 23rd. And of course, we had all hoped that they would be ending the sleeping ban at that meeting, and that is what they was their duty to do.
Go ahead. Sorry about that. So we have a somewhat rotten mic here, folks. You may need earmuffs to get through the rest of this, but let's see. Go ahead.
Sorry about blasting your ears out there, free radio audience, but of course you're used to it.
So I know that you've been attending a lot of the task force meetings, as I call them, the group of three council members, Crone, Sugar, and Byers, that got together. Interestingly enough, it was Crone, Sugar, and Byers, not Fitzmaurice, Sugar, and Crone, the three new council members who got the electoral mandate. Rather, Byers kind of stepped into the traces to take command and essentially led us off on a kind of a goose chase to nowhere with this camping ordinance. At least that's how I heard it described by one person today, and I kind of agree with that. What do you think?
Well, it had to be Byers because Catherine Byers fashions herself as being a person who has an above-normal compassion level for homeless people, and she has been on the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, the seat she took over after Celia Scott had filled that seat for 6 years, and that so she and now she's on the Homeless Services Center Board of Directors as well. So had she not been on that task force, it would have been kind of reflected badly upon her. Unfortunately, she was not a good person to have on this board. She doesn't have the wherewithal to really go up against the people who really have very bigoted attitudes towards homeless people and represent a lot of the moneyed interests in property owners and business owners.
Wait a minute. She has a red Jaguar. Certainly that's a step in the right direction.
She fits right in with them in the parking lot, that's for sure.
Well, maybe she's able to talk to those folks as her peers and persuade them that it's okay to have homeless people sleeping perhaps in a vehicle nearby, that it's not going to be the end of the world. Did she take an educational position and tell people that people have to sleep in Santa Cruz after all, since there are 500 to 1,500 homeless people and less than 30 shelter spaces after March 15th and less than 220 now, and that there's really not much else that can be done? Wasn't that her position?
Wouldn't characterize it that way.
Well, no, I'm actually making a rhetorical question. It obviously wasn't her position. Her position was throughout, it seemed to be, well, first she said she didn't know whether she favored ending the sleeping ban, and then she ended up coming down with no changes at all in the sleeping sections except the penalty section, and a number of advocates in desperation rushed in with some, a series of small changes, David Silva among them. I guess Paul Brindell proposed a major change, and
you're talking about the change in hours down from instead of the 9.5 hours.
These were changes proposed by David Silva, but I'm saying Mayor Byers fundamentally had decided that there was no place that homeless people could sleep in Santa Cruz, and that's why she didn't favor the solution that we talked about earlier that Theodore Carey referred to, the Sleeping Ban Repeal Initiative solution, or the solution, let's say, that the county uses in Santa Cruz, which is they have no camping zones, and then the rest of the county is an okay-to-camp zone. Though you wouldn't know that if you talked to the deputies, but that is, in fact, the law. And also, Mayor Byers, you said she got herself on this task force because she, you know,
enjoys a reputation as being very knowledgeable and a leader on homeless issues.
You know, it's interesting. I see it in a somewhat more sinister sense. I feel like she didn't want Fitzmaurice, Crone, and Sugar to run away and maybe make some real changes, so instead she inserted herself into a situation where she could maintain control over the issue. I don't think it was just that, oh gosh, homelessness, that's my issue, I want to keep that issue, you know, because I like that issue. I think it was more, she saw this was a hot potato and she wanted to cool it off and maybe even deep freeze it.
Well, that she did, because after going through these endless task force meetings where hundreds of hours of citizens and city staff members on the payroll, as well as the council members.
And us activists who wasted, dozens of hours going to those things and writing flyers about them and acting as though they were a serious consideration of the issues.
And homeless people who had to come to those task force meetings or eat their meal, the 4 o'clock meal.
Yeah, the task force meetings were strategically placed so that at 4 o'clock, so that therefore that's the same time as the free meal at the homeless services center is served. You either got to go to eat your meal if you were homeless, or you got to come to the task force if you use the free meal regularly. And also that's when the Winter Armory shelter line begins, and so you had to choose between a shelter place or getting there late and worrying about that whole situation. So in effect, homeless people were kind of inferentially screened out of those meetings.
So at the February 1st task force, Mayor Byers dropped the bombshell that she had thought over the weekend and had actually, she said she'd actually lost sleep over it, and she had decided that she couldn't support any modifications in the sleeping ban or the blanket ban, but was only willing to downwardly modify the fines. And of course, this was just a devastating blow for all of us who had worked so hard, since Byers' vote is crucial to have a 4-vote majority on the city council in order to end the sleeping ban. And if she wasn't willing to support it, it wasn't going to happen.
Devastating, but not really unexpected, since I thought this whole caravanserai took off across the desert under Byers' leadership, you know, looking for imaginary sleeping places. I mean, she pulled this number two or three years ago when she and Celia Scott supposedly ran around town looking for a campground site in order to cover up the fact that the Coral Street Open Air Shelter was being closed down.
And she was there when they closed it down and sat silently and didn't say a word.
Yeah, she was there. But she was also on the board of directors of Citizens Committee for the Homeless, at least during a part of that period. And she was also on the subcommittee that was supposedly looking for a campground site. And of course, they had to appear to be looking for a campground site because they had hundreds of people who needed lodging and were eventually sent into a form of kind of exile. They become internal refugees through then-Mayor Rapkin's policy. They became known as the River Street refugees. And Byers, of course, then for the several years that followed, on this particular campground site situation, she said they just couldn't find any place to put these homeless people, even though the campground from which they were all evicted remained vacant for the next 18 months.
And she was on a subcommittee with me that tried to reopen that property, at least temporarily, we had endless meetings and all kinds of inputs, and then she just announced, well, she just couldn't support it. Oh, well.
You're talking, of course, about the Citizens Committee for the Homeless that ran that property and ran the Coral Street.